Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Jimmy A. from Neptune, New Jersey.
Thanks, Glenn. Hi, everybody. I'm Jimmy, an alcoholic. Amen. Grateful to be alive and sober. And my home group is the Design for Living Group in Neptune, New Jersey, down on the Jersey Shore. I have a sponsor. I sponsor a lot of men. And most importantly, I've been sober since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was on March 28, 1987. And I don't say that egotistically. I just say that for anyone who's in here right now, whether you have 30 minutes, 30 days, or 30 years, you never have to drink again. Now, you might be afraid a couple times. You might be pissed off a lot. You might be really aggravated with what's going on in your life. You might even be quite thirsty at times, but you never have to drink again. And see, there's a condition to that. And the condition is that you need to be in this deal. That you need to be in the middle of this triangle, working these steps, helping others, being of service in any way that you can in order to stick and stay. When I got here earlier, Tom was putting out the ashtrays. And, you know, there's no meetings really where I'm from where they're smoking still. And, but I'll always remember day 7 of my sobriety. Because on day 7, a man came up to me and said, I want you to clean the ashtrays. And in my mind, I said, you know what I said, you know. But for whatever reason, because I never smoked a cigarette in my life, but for whatever reason, I listened to that intuitive voice inside me. And I knew the guy wasn't trying to hurt me, and I trusted him. And I told him, what do I need to do? And from that day, on day 7, to this moment right now, I've had a job in Alcoholics Anonymous. Whether it's been in my home group, whether it's been in my district, whether it's been in the area. I've been in the middle of this deal. And again, I don't say that egotistically, it's just how I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous with a lot of good old times in my life at the time. So it's really nice to be here. I'd like to thank Lauren for the invite. I was supposed to be here in March, but I just got my knee replaced, and I'm hopping around now at 5 months with a knee replacement, but feeling good enough to play golf today, of course. You know. So came up with my buddy Rich, sponsee, and my son. It was his 27th birthday today, so... That's what we do on birthdays, Father's Days. We play golf, you know, a little of a golf addict. Great alcoholic sport if you haven't never played golf. You could be horrible for 17 holes, but on the 18th hole, one good shot, I can't wait till tomorrow, you know. So, but it's really nice to be here. I've been here a few times in the past, out here and inside. So I'm in this railroad room apartment. If you don't know what a railroad room apartment is, these were apartments that they built outside of New York City after World War I, where everyone would come. And I lived in Jersey City, New Jersey, which is where Ellis Island is. And all the people would come through Ellis Island, and they would land in these railroad room apartments. And in these railroad room apartments, your whole family would live, your grandparents, your aunts, your uncles, your cousins. You know, they were really long halls with a lot of rooms. And I find myself in a room one day with this guy named Bill Grace. And I'm sitting there with him, or I'm really standing there, and he's got a Jack Russell. Now, I don't know if anyone knows what a Jack Russell is. They're kind of crazy dogs, yeah, exactly. And the way I describe his Jack Russell was like bringing a newcomer to a meeting and giving him 30 cups of coffee and letting him loose. I mean, this dog was running the walls. But I'm in this room with him and his Jack Russell, and he's asking me a few questions. First question he asked me, how long can you hold your breath? How long can you be in a 12-step program and not work the 12 steps? What does your relationship with God look like? Well, I believe in God. I just don't see any purpose for God in this deal. Then he asked me a question where a lot of you guys are not going to believe this, but this is the way it was back when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, where's your big book? And I looked at him and I said, what's a big book? Now, I'm not embarrassed by those answers. I'm probably more embarrassed to tell you that I was 5 years sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous at the time. See, back in my neighborhood in the early 80s or mid-80s, we didn't talk about the book like we do today. Back then, it was speaker meetings, discussion meetings, and 12 and 12 meetings. You know, so when he asked me those questions, you know, I'm 5 years not drinking in Alcoholics Anonymous, very active in a home group, doing everything we do in a home group, but dying in the rooms of AA because I didn't know what I was suffering from. I didn't understand what I was suffering from. It's called untreated alcoholism. I was physically sober, but I'm dying. I'm spiritually dead. I'm emotionally dead. I'm in a lot of trouble. And that day is the day that changed my life. I'd like to tell you that I was born perfect and quickly handed over to these two character defects called Mom and Dad. And I always say that little stupid joke for the same, for the main purpose that, you know, like many of us and a lot of guys I sponsor anyway, you know, it's really easy to blame people for the way I feel, for the circumstances of my life. And obviously my parents were the first one who got everything from me. Now my parents, all they ever tried to do is give me morals, give me value, you know, gave me great education. They gave me everything I ever needed to succeed. But for whatever reason, I took it like a, rolled it up in a ball and I just tried to jam it down their throat. But little did my parents know that 7 miles from my house where I grew up and 20 years earlier, there was a group of people. And what they were in this building called 17 William Street in the office of Honored Dealers. And what they were doing was writing this book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And this fledgling society gave us that book. And what that book gave me, and probably many in this room or this out here right now, is that my life, the life that my parents always try to give me. You know, it's through those 12 steps that my life has been recreated. And as I go on through my story, you'll see how I've tried to blow that up a couple of times, because there's three types of people that come to Alcoholics Anonymous. People who make it happen, people who watch it happen, and people who don't know what the hell's happening. And I've been all three of those guys in my 32 years of sobriety. So, you know, I wake up, I grow up in this blue-collar neighborhood. I grow up right on the other side of New York City, in Jersey City. It's right off on the other side of the Hudson River, right outside the Holland Tunnel. It's a blue-collar neighborhood. All the dads worked. All the moms stayed home. The only requirement for membership in the neighborhood was five or more kids. So there was always a lot of kids. There was always a lot of parties. There was always a lot of alcohol going on. And, you know, so my dad, who was cunning, baffling, and powerful in his own way, a Korean War vet, a really tough guy, a guy you don't screw around with. He was a butcher, knew how to handle knives pretty well, and meat cleavers. But he wasn't an alcoholic. But he seemed to be all over page 52 a lot of his life. He always seemed to be angry about something, or aggravated, or feelings of fear. He had all those things we always talk about with ourselves. But what I would see is every night at 5 o'clock, the magic of alcohol. And I'm 8, I'm 9 years old. And what I would see every time, every night at 5 o'clock, is my mother would make these two pitchers of drinks. One Manhattan and one martini. And what I would see is my dad take that first drink. And what I would notice, or what I would witness, is the ease and comfort that comes at once by taking that first drink. And my father would take that first drink, and all of a sudden he became the happy dad. He became the dad that wanted to go out in the yard and have a catch. He became the dad that wanted to go have, you know, tell some jokes. But once in a while, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde showed up. Because once in a while, Dad would show up, and guess what? He'd have that drink, but then all of a sudden the plates would be going across the kitchen. Once in a while, the kitchen chairs would be flying across the kitchen. Once in a while, he'd grab one of us young kids, we'd be flying across the kitchen. So, you know, you never know who showed up in my house. But for whatever reason, I was able to just push that aside, because I always looked at the magic of alcohol. And with all these kids and all these parties and all these birthday parties and christenings, you know, all I would see is the neighbors, my uncles, and I can't wait to do it. Now, I haven't had a drink. I'm 8, I'm 9, I'm 10 years old. I can't wait to have a drink and do what seems to be like a lot of fun. And that day came. I was 13 years old. I was with five guys. I can mention their name right now. 48 years ago. I don't even know how the hell I got here today. 48 years ago, I can remember. And here I am in a cemetery with these five guys, and here comes that first bottle of booze. It was Colt 45 malt liquor. And I reach in my hand, and again, I got those strong warnings from my parents. I better not be hanging out with those kids, but here I am with those kids. And I start sucking on that Colt 45 malt liquor, and here comes that second bottle, Mohawk Blackberry Brandy. And I start drinking that Mohawk Blackberry Brandy. And I can't tell you how sick I got. I can't tell you the beating I took from my father. I can't talk about how much I puked purple for about 3 weeks. I was grounded for life. But on that day, the hook was put in. I couldn't wait to do it again. I couldn't wait to do it again. Now, again, I'm 13 years old. And what I do know today that I can look back then is that I'm alcoholic right out of the gate. And how do I know that? Because I know what I suffer from today. And I know when I was 13 years old, I had no power, choice, or control once I started to drink. I know then I had no power, choice, or control in my mind prior to the first drink. So after that weekend, the obsession to drink was in. I can't wait till next Friday. I can't wait till after the football game. I can't wait till after the dance. I can't wait to be with those guys again and recreate what we just did 2 weeks ago. I'm an alcoholic. I know it today. I also know a very important piece of this puzzle right now. And it took me a long time in the rooms of alcoholics to find that out. That I got this thing deep down within. Some of us call it a soul sickness. Some of us call it, I'll tell you what the old timers used to call it. They used to say alcoholism is a soul sickness caused by a separation from God and a disconnect from each other. You know, when I look back now, I can see how disconnected I really was from God. And I think a lot of us can look back at that drinking career we had and see that at the end of my rope, guess what? I drank in isolation all the time. I drank in loneliness. I didn't have friends. I didn't have family. I had nothing. I was homeless for 2 years at the end of my run. So, you know, this thing called alcohol, again, I can't wait to do it again. I'm 13, 14, 15. I'm not going to bore you with a bunch of little stories, but, you know, I can't wait to drink. And when I drink alcoholically. I'm a blackout drinker from the get-go, and I can't wait to do it again. I'm 18 years old. I get out of a prep school that I went to that my mother basically got me out of because she was a secretary to the principal. Always in trouble, always in a lot of trouble. You know, my weekend spent down on the Jersey Shore, you know, you guys might have, you know, experienced this, you know, one bedroom, 15 guys, 10 kegs of beer, you know, one of those types of houses, you know, great time, you know. But I wound up going to college. I go to college out in Pennsylvania, out here, and I go with 9 friends from Jersey City. We go to the University of Scranton, and I'm out in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and, you know, and again, school's not real important to me, classes, any of that stuff. I'm with the guys that I grow up with, guys that I'm hanging with, and we're drinking. And after 1 year, I get tossed out. I come back to New Jersey, and you know, it's really, you know, we live life forward, we understand it backwards, obviously. I look back at my life back then, and, you know, I'm in a lot of trouble, but I don't see the trouble. You know, I got this disease of perception that it doesn't look that bad. Matter of fact, I'm still the guy who still blames you, still blames her, still blames not enough money, still blames a lot of things for the way I feel. But I come back to New Jersey, and I have no education, no trade, you know, really don't have a hook on getting a good union job anywhere. You know, I start my day every morning. By the time I'm 18, 19, 20 years old, I start in a corner bar down the house, down a block from my house. Once in a while, I'll go to the union hall, try to get a job. You know, I'm trying to be an iron worker. Little do I know, I'm afraid of heights. That doesn't work out real well. And I'm kind of lost. I'm kind of lost. But see, drinking's not a problem. It's all these circumstances of my life that's the problem. You know, that I don't have a relationship, that I have a lot of problems with my parents, that I'm getting arrested a lot for a lot of things that I'm doing. I mean, it's everything out there. It's never anything inside me. You know? So I'm in a bar one day, and I see a pretty girl. She's right over there, you know, and I see my sister over here. I say, introduce me to that girl, and I'll buy you an illegal substance. She does. I meet the girl, and 7 months later, I'm engaged to get married, and that's how I do relationships. I'm not real good at being responsible. I'm not real good at caring about anyone. I'm not real good about this very, very big word that I didn't understand called intimacy. I didn't know what trust meant. I didn't even know what caring meant. I didn't know how to love another person because I didn't even like me or love myself. But I'm under the delusion that if I get married, maybe everything will just pan out. But I'm alcoholic, and I don't know it yet. So I get married to this woman, and I, 4 months into the marriage, I walk out of the marriage because drinking's more important than being a husband. Drinking's more important than being a friend. Drinking's more important than, you know, than anything. And I walk out of this marriage, and I take off of Boca Raton, Florida, my home away from home. And I'm down in Boca Raton, Florida. I'm about 25 years old at this time. And I'm in this apartment, which is all glass, a condo. A friend of the family who's well off. They had a beautiful condo on the beach, all glass. And I'm looking out at that glass, out the glass, and there's the boats, the beach, the bikinis, I mean, everything a man would want. But I'm stuck inside this room. And I'm stuck inside this room because I'm being driven by this guilt and this shame and this remorse. Because somewhere along the line, God put this chalkboard in my mind. Maybe some. This has happened to a few of you. And on that chalkboard, there's these three categories. One called shame. Another category called remorse. And the other one called guilt. And everything I have done up to in my life up to this point has created one of those feelings in all three sides. The shame that I've quit jobs, the shame that I didn't make it through college, the shame that I walked out of a marriage. The remorse of how I've hurt so many people in my life. My family, that ex-wife, that, you know, all these people. The guilt of the way I'm living, of living on the streets, stealing, robbing, thieving, you know, doing all those things to get money. So all these things that are driving forces. But here's what I found out, being in the rooms pretty long time now, that you can't outrun your shame in here. You can't outrun your guilt in here. And you'll never outrun your remorse in here. And it was through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that I was able to address that stuff and look at that stuff and get an honest perspective of that stuff with the help of a sponsor and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stand here today with no shame in my life because most alcoholics are shame-based. I sit here really with no guilt in my life about anything. And I stand here with absolutely no remorse in my life about anything I've ever done. Because I'm a true believer that the dark past becomes the greatest asset we ever have. That we get to help other people with all the troubles we've had. And I've seen that countless times in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm in this condo, and guess what? I'm getting that knock every day, like a lot of us get. It's the four horsemen: terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. And see, I know that guilt and that shame wants me. But I know another little trick. It's called the bottle of Johnny Walker Red. And all I need to do is crack the seal. I don't even need to take that first drink. And I already know that I'm going to have the ease and comfort that comes at once. And I would take that drink, and all of a sudden, screw her. Screw them. And all of a sudden, that perfect little kid that was born to these two character defects is again blaming everyone else for the way I feel deep down within. You know, I'm a jerk. I mean, you know, that's all I could tell you. I mean, I eventually come back to New Jersey, and for the next 18 months of my life, I lived on the streets of Jersey City, landing here, landing there, no real employment, shaping out a trucking company here, doing some side work for somebody here, always running, always trying to, you know, do what I have to do to get some money. And walk in a bar another day, and they said to me, Jimmy, you need to go to Newark Airport. They're hiring guys like you. Finally, being acknowledged for my potential. And I go to Newark Airport, and I walk into a room that's probably about the same size as this, maybe a little bit bigger. I am so broken that I don't even know I'm broken. I am in so much trouble. I am dying, and I don't know what I'm dying from. And for years, I could not tell you or explain that feeling I had in that day in Newark Airport until I landed in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and read Bill's story for the first time. And when Bill talks about hitting his bottom and, you know, talking about his first step experience, you know, that no words could tell the loneliness and despair. I felt in a bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I met my match. Alcohol is my master. And looking back, that's the way I felt in that moment. But in that next moment, a stranger sat next to me. And when that stranger sat next to me, you know, we just looked at each other. And then after a couple of minutes, he asked me a question. Now, at this time, the questions that I was being asked wasn't like, you know, how's your 401 or how are your kids? He looked at me and said, what's your problem? And for whatever reason, a moment of clarity, God's grace, I spit up my life story on this guy, this complete stranger, in about 10 minutes. And he looked at me and said, I have the solution for you. And I said, what's that? He goes, is it possible for you not to pick up a drink the rest of this day? I said, I don't know. He goes, where do you live? I said, I don't have any residence to live, you know, an address. And he pulled out a piece of paper and he wrote down an address. He said, try to be in front of this house at 7 o'clock tonight and please try not to drink. And all I can say is for the grace of God, I wound up at 7 o'clock that night sober in front of this house. And this stranger pulled up in a car filled of other strangers. And they said, probably the most important thing you'll ever hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, get in the car. And I got in the car with these guys, and I didn't know who they were. And they took me around the corner to my grammar school. And they brought me into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, that was on March 28, 1987. I haven't left since. That amazes me to this moment still, that I've stayed when so many of us leave. I walk into my first meeting, and just like tonight, you guys lived up to your responsibility. You shook my hand when I got here. You said, welcome. Cup of coffee? Bathrooms? You told me what to do. And when I walked into that meeting, I did the same thing. They reached their hand out to me. They pulled me into this recovery thing, this lifeboat called Alcoholics Anonymous. They sat me up front. They gave me a half a cup of coffee. And they gave me something that night that we are responsible to give every newcomer or every person who might be falling asleep in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. They gave me back my dignity that night because they didn't judge me. They didn't care what I looked like. They didn't care that every other word out of my mouth was a profanity. Keep coming back, kid. Keep coming back. And as much as that was a miracle, day two was even more of a miracle. Because on day two, this guy, Richie Schnorr, who met me in Newark Airport, picked me up for a meeting at 8 o'clock in the morning. Now, I'm a street guy. I'm a tough guy. I'm a guy who doesn't talk about emotions. I'm a guy who stuffs down everything. I don't talk about how I feel. I don't talk about any of that stuff. It's the street creed. We don't do that stuff. But on that day, when Richie showed up, I said to him, now, this might sound quite simplistic, but I want a drink. I would never tell anyone I want a drink. I would never tell anything to anybody about how I feel. But I want a drink. And he goes, I know you do. And that was my first experience of what a trusted servant is. Because what Richie did was he got on the phone and he called his wife and said, listen, I got a newcomer. I won't be home for the rest of the day. And he wound up taking me to 3 meetings that day. I must have drank 700 cups of coffee, but, you know, a little buzz, but, you know. But by the end of that night, I didn't want to drink. And I started to meet people. And I started to get involved. And I started to be brought into a home group. And I started to learn what we do in a home group. And I started to make coffee. And I started to greet people. And I started to clean ashtrays. And I started to set up the chairs. And I started to do all these things. Except for recover. And at 5 years without a drink, I'm at a podium just like I am right now. And I'm asked to speak on the second step. And I'm lying to every one of you because I'm paralyzed by what you think of me. I'm paralyzed that I'm not good enough. I'm paralyzed that you're going to judge me. I'm paralyzed that all this negative and all this insecurity that I'm walking around with, I think that you guys are just, you know, coming at me. But I'm at this podium and I'm lying to every one of you because I want to look good. And I'm talking on the second step, came to believe in a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Now, I have limited belief in a power. I read the 12 and 12, so I know I could, you know, steal lines out of that. I know I could tell a couple of jokes once in a while. But I'm at this podium, I'm lying to every one of you. At the end of the line, the cha-cha line comes up, good job, good job, good job, you know, all shaking hand. All of a sudden, a guy who's, I'm 6'4", he's 6'4", he walks right up to me and looks me eyeball to eyeball and says, you're screwed. In a little bit salty language. Now, I want to step back because I don't want to hit this guy, but I want to hit this guy. Because I don't know how to face resistance with no resistance. I don't know how to face conflict without violence. These are still things that are still inside me that have not gone away because of just going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and stop drinking. I'm still a violent person. And I want to hit this guy in the meeting of AA. But again, another moment of clarity of God's grace, I step back and I look at him in his eyes and said, you're right, I need help. And what happened was that next day I find myself in September of 1992 in that railroad room apartment with this guy named Bill Grace, who came from St. Paul, Minnesota into Jersey City with the big book underneath his arm. And he was talking a language in meetings that no one ever heard before. I know that sounds so crazy even when I say it. We used to have business meetings where the old times would tell us, young guys, to stay away from that guy with that blue book. Why? They felt threatened, I guess. Or fear, I guess. I'm not sure. But what happened was I started to go through the steps for the first time with this guy at 5 years. I started to understand what I'm really up against, this this allergy of the body, this phenomena called craving. I didn't understand any of that stuff. He asked me, what makes you alcoholic? And all I can come up with, the best I could think of, was I drank too much. I had no idea about the phenomena called craving. I had no idea about the allergy or the obsession. And more importantly, I didn't know about the thing that drives us all, that thing deep down inside. My good friend Mickey out in Denver says it all the time. Where does it hurt? Where does it really hurt? And I wish I could have told you at that time. But he would always say this. If you don't put something spiritual in that hole, nothing will ever change in your life. And I started to understand that. So I started to go through the steps with this guy, Bill. And again, you know, real simplistic here. This guy was really simple, you know. You know, we'd be in his house. It's all glass. And he'd say, Jimmy, here's the real goal. Here's the goal of Alcoholics Anonymous, is to get out there in the sunlight of the spirit and to enjoy the freedom that we offer. And the only way that you're going to get out there is by taking these steps and start to get down the causes and conditions of the things that are blocking you from being a free man out there. It's almost like you have to clean up this whole room in order to step out that door. And the simplicity of what he was telling me made so much sense. That what I needed to do was I needed to come to believe in a power, or not even come to believe in a power. All I needed was a mustard seed of willingness to believe in something in a second step. It was good enough to go. And then on the third step, I'll never forget, I was on my knees holding this man's hands. I've never held a man's hands in my life. I was ashamed of what I was doing. I was afraid of what I was doing. I was also looking out the corner of my eye so nobody saw me holding another man's hands. Because tough guys like me don't hold man's hands. But I said that prayer, and when I got up, I started to write my inventory pretty quickly. And I started to look at the things in my life that were blocking me from God, the resentments, the fears, and the sexual conduct. He took me deeper into financial harms. He took me deeper into emotional harms. He took me deeper into physical harms. I had a lot of amends to make in the past. But as I went through that stuff, I made an appointment. I did that fifth step. My original fifth step was the most powerful day of my life, other than my two children being born. Because I'll never forget being in that delivery room, and for you parents that are here right now, I'll never forget when that doctor handed me my daughter. I couldn't believe it. There was something in my heart that split in half, an emotion that I never felt in my life before. And when he said, cut that cord, I'm like, holy shit, I'm a dad. I couldn't believe it. And then the same thing with my son 3 years later. And I got back with that wife that I walked out on. And through much counseling, she joined Al-Anon. And I was going with AA. We started to do a lot of things together. After that fifth step, well, let me back up. When I did that fifth step, the thing that was so powerful was when I was instructed to take the hour to go down, find a place. He told me not to go home. I went down to a place called Liberty State Park that's right on the Hudson River. I walked out on this pier, this jetty that jet out from the island. And I sat down and I started to read the first five proposals. I started to ask all those questions in that last paragraph. I looked up and I saw the Statue of Liberty, which was right there. I looked up and there's the World Trade Center right in front of me. Looked up and there's Ellis Island right there. Symbols of freedom today. And as I sat there, I could feel the arms of God wrapped around me for the first time in my life. And at 32 years old, for the first time in my life, I knew I was going to be okay. I knew if I kept on hanging out with you guys and kept doing what he was asking me to do and keep participating in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was going to be okay. But then I fell for the biggest trap. The biggest trap we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell prey to emotion. And I fell prey to comfortability. Because after that fifth step, all of a sudden a lot of other stuff became more important. Overtime, coaching baseball, coaching basketball. Now, nothing wrong with those things. But those things just took over my primary purpose of helping another alcoholic. And see, the old timers used to say the same all the time. Maybe you guys have heard it before. But don't let the life that AA gave you take you away from your AA life. And what happened was I was starting to move away from my AA life. So 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, I'm with this wife. We're having a lot of trouble. Well, you know, I built the White House. I built a beautiful home. We got the white picket fence. I got a brand new job. I got money in my pocket. I got the, you know, all the things that I need material wise out there. But I'm dying again. And I don't even know how that happened. I'm dying in rooms again. You know, to the untrained eye, it looks like normal living is a solution to alcoholism. And it isn't. So at 10 years without a drink, you know, I walk out on my wife again. I bury her again. And I don't drink. I just walk into the arms of a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I blow up my life. I'm the guy the book talks about when he says, I build this beautiful spiritual structure up and I tear it down with a senseless series of sprees. And I'm here to tell you that you don't need to be drinking to blow your life up in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of us go on a lot of different types of sprees. It's called the sex spree, the money spree, the food spree, the anger spree, the gambling spree. A lot of us blow our lives up in a lot of different ways before I even pick up a drink. But the problem at 10 years with sobriety, I'm not telling my sponsor anything. I'm giving them about 20% of what's really going on in my life. See, I'm ashamed again of where I landed now. I'm 10 years, I'm cheating on my wife, or I'm in this relationship, and I'm doing things that I would never do in my life. 13 years, I'm standing in at a podium, or something like this, and there's a judge right there. I'm in a courtroom, 13 years sober. And this judge is holding a New Jersey meeting book, and he's circling meetings. You're banned from this one. You're banned from this one. You're banned from this one. Who the hell gets banned from AA meetings? I do. Because that's how angry I am. And that's how I take it out on other people. And this woman that I was in a relationship with was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started to stalk her, I started to threaten her, and I started to do things that were just bizarre. That was never my intention, but that's where my illness brought me right back. And that's not the cop for the illness. That's just who I became again. I was a stalk raving sober. I was an animal. And I'm not telling anybody what's really going on. I'm the guy that the book talks about in the fifth step. I'm living this double life. Jimmy, how's everything going? Oh, everything's great. But God forbid I tell you the truth of what's really going on in my life. And see, when you live that way of dishonesty, it's only a matter of time before you drink. And at 13 years, I walk into a bar in Red Bank, New Jersey, and I go to the bartender, give me a drink. Now, Dr. Bob talks about being stuck between a rock and a hard place in his story. But here I am, and I'm in a bar, the drink's right there. I got the angel and the devil on both shoulders. Drink it, don't drink it, drink it, don't drink it. Felt like 20 minutes, could have been 20 seconds, I'm not even sure. But all of a sudden, a hand went around that drink and pulled it back. And when I looked up, it just happens to be one of us that happens to be a bartender. And he says, what are you doing? Well, apparently throwing 13 years of sobriety away. And I walked out of there. I've never felt so defeated and broken again, again, again. You know, we talk in here about hitting bottom, but there's a second bottom for a lot of us. There's a third bottom for some of us. Sometimes there's a fourth and a fifth bottom in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous if I don't stay plugged in. And what happened was a couple of days later, I went to this workshop, and this guy was doing a workshop, and I asked him to sponsor me. And Peter, a lot of you guys know Peter, and he became my sponsor for the next 15 years. And what happened is he took me through the process again, through the 12 steps again, blah, 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 blah. I did all my amends, finished up all that stuff, and, you know, went through a divorce, 1999. I'm on the job. I work for the Highway Authority. And I was in a bad accident, bad, bad accident. And I got retired on that day, December 6, 1999, at 41 years old. I've had 41 operations since 2001. I'm really 5'8", but with all the metal in me, I'm 6'4 now. That's what I say. But it changed my life. It changed my life, you know. And I got put out to retirement, you know, all that other stuff that goes on, workman's comp, Social Security, all that other stuff. Now what am I going to do? Now what am I going to do with all this free time? I can tell you right now, I could never fit an 8-hour day back in my life again. That's how busy I got in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So my wife or my girlfriend or a friend at that time, she was booking speakers for the World Trade Center There was a meeting every day at the World Trade Center called the Tower Group at 12:15, and she was the booker. And when the towers came down, a lot of us perished in that tragedy. But she would book for those things and ask me to come over, my friends, you know, a lot of us from Jersey, because we were so close to the World Trade Center. And so, you know, I went over there, and a talk became, a cup of coffee became lunch, and all of a sudden, you know, became an engagement. And we'll be married 17 years this year, you know, or 16 years this year. And I can't tell you what a difference out my life is from then and today. I like to tell you, I live in a recovered home. See, you walk into my house, there's no trauma. There's no anger. I think the most me and my wife have fought over the last 16 years is who's going to get the kitchen table tonight. It's an unbelievable thing when you have a partner in Alcoholics Anonymous who takes care of herself. And knowing that I'm taking care of myself, that when we come home, we live in the fellowship of the Spirit as a husband and a wife. And I never knew that that was possible in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I always thought my relationships going on my track record was always about push and pull. And it's not like that in my life anymore. I'm so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous has entered my home in a way that I never thought could happen. But we're together, and you know, we want to start this meeting. We have a big book meeting. I know Dave was down there once, and Rich somewhere, wherever he is. They came down, and Jeff used to come down, and you know, we want to put this big book meeting together. And so I got a steering. Me and my wife got a steering committee of 12 people, and we put it together, and we ironed out what we wanted to do, and then we went to prayer. Because all we wanted was 30 people to show up on the first night. We prayed for 30 people to show up. And on January 22nd, 2006, 175 people walked through our doors. And we average anywhere between 250 and 300 every Sunday night now. And it's really a pocket of enthusiasm when you walk in and, you know, you come an hour and a half early and there's two girls sitting over here reading a book. There's two girls over there, two guys over here. You can feel the spirit when you walk in. It is something that I can't believe is it's just an unbelievable feeling walking into my home group on a Sunday night, you know. And it's really strange where God takes you in this deal. Because when I started that meeting, or when we started that meeting, I was like 19, 20 years sober. And if you asked me back then, would I be doing what I'm doing now, I would say there's no way possible. So we were a meeting and we became a home group. In order to be a home group, we have to be connected to Alcoholics Anonymous, and we needed a GSR. And everyone said, Jimmy, why don't you be the GSR? And I'm like, no way in hell am I doing that. I hate service. Right? By the way, my middle name is Content prior to investigation. Because the 2 year sobriety, I went to a district meeting, and you guys were talking about a pamphlet, and I took it at like a union meeting, like, who the hell wants to be part of this? And I walked out. Never to come back until 19 years sober. So I become the GSR of this group. And all of a sudden, I'm starting to learn more about the structure of Alcoholics Anonymous than I ever knew before. One day, I'm in a meeting, and there's this real tall guy in New Jersey. And he's having an unofficial poll of the meeting in Alcoholics in this meeting. And he's asking everyone a question. And here's the question. How did you get to AA? How did you get to AA? And the point he was trying to drive home is that none of us were walking by on this road and Kate said, let's go get sober and walk in this place right now. That it's always been a piece of literature. It's always been a service. It's always been someone who's got us to our first meeting. Maybe it's happened where one person's walked in and just sat down in a meeting and stayed sober. But the point he was trying to drive home is that it's always been some service entity that has gotten us here. Whether it was the judge, whether it was the cops, whether it was the employee assistance program, whether it was the correctional facility or the treatment center that you went to, something got us here. And I started to understand that. And I started to look at my life. And I started to think about that guy, Richie, who died, who carried me into this room in 1987. And the reason why he got here was because of his employee assistance program. And I started to understand the third legacy that we have of service. And as I was the GSR, I became the DCM, I became a section coordinator, blah, 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 blah. I put my, you know, my, he used to say, just make yourself available. You know, anyone ever do this before? Like, raise your hand for a commitment, and you're like, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? You know, like that. Have conversations with your arm. I do that all the time. But before you know it, I get elected as the alternate chairperson of New Jersey, Area 44. Before you know it, 2 years later, I get elected as the chairperson of Area 44. And I don't say this to be, and please don't take it this in any egotistical way. But last October, I got elected. I'm the alternate delegate to this General Service Conference for Area 44. Now, what does that all mean? It just means I have a responsibility, just like everyone in this crowd right now. We all have a responsibility. And what's that responsibility? There's only one responsibility in Alcoholics Anonymous. Is to make sure that door is open when that new person shows up. That's our responsibility. And as an individual alcohol, a member, as a member of AA, as an individual member of AA, I do my part. Just like you do your part, you do your part, you do your part, you do your part. And I'll never forget, he said, Jimmy, I want you to read this thing called the service manual. Oh my God. Well, what's really important about that service manual is this. There's a little speech in there from a conference, a 1950 General Service Conference. It's written by a Class A trustee, a non-alcoholic. I've met many of them through the years. There's a lot of non-alcoholics that care more about AA than some of our members, sadly. But in this speech, this guy, Byrne Smith, is talking about, you know, why do we do what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous? Why do we have a conference? Why do we debate and vote and do all this stuff we do? Why do we vote on the fifth edition of a big book this year? Why do we do all that stuff? It's not to ensure our recovery. Why? We're here already. You know what to do when a young girl comes. You get her at that kitchen table, you take her through the book, she has an experience, and she passes it on. Same for you guys. We know that. But why we do what we do is for the guy who's out there right now in Quakertown who's sucking on his second bottle of whiskey today doesn't know that right now in this room there's 50, 60 guys in here that have a solution to his problem. Right now in Quakertown somewhere, there's a single mom with three kids who can't wait to put them down and crack a bottle of wine to wash her day away. Right now, and I don't know if there's a hospital in Quakertown, but there's a baby being born destined for alcoholism right now in this moment. So the point he was driving home to me is that we have a responsibility. And we say our pledge all the time. I am responsible when anyone anywhere reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA to always be there. For that, I am responsible. And that's the message I got. And in my last 12 years, along with sponsoring a bunch of guys and sitting on my kitchen table, taking them through that blue book, being an active member of my home group, being an active member in the service structure, I've been placed right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been placed in that place where my parents wanted me when I was born, to have morals, to have values, to think about others, to be of service to others, to care, to be responsible, and to show respect to others. All those things were foreign to me at one point until I landed in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a result of that, we used to do a thing back in the old days, a 90-day pinning. We did that in New Jersey. I don't know if you do it in Pennsylvania. And what they would do is, you know, you get the crusty old timer sponsor you had, and he'd walk up and, you know, he'd show you the triangle and a circle, and he'd say, yeah, that G over here is for God, that AA over there is for AA. And he'd make sure that you understood that the little insignificant dot in the middle of that triangle was you, you know, so he'd really rub it in, you know. But he would always say this. He would always say, you know what, but if you keep one hand in God and one hand in AA, you'll never have a hand to pick up a drink. And how true that's been in my life and for many people that I know. You know, we have a good friend. He died. He passed on. He was a great speaker. His name was Judge Jack from Maryland. And Judge Jack, you know, he would go to conferences all around America. And if he got to know you, he would send a postcard from wherever he was at. So if he was here right now, I'd get a postcard tomorrow. Dear Jimmy and Mary Beth, I'm out in Quakertown. People are great. They still smoke at meetings, but that's okay. On and on and on and on. But at the end of every postcard that he wrote, he would write this. Sober sure is better. Love Jack. Boy, he wasn't lying. Thank you for my life.